He struggled to control his breathing. Every ounce of him wanted to run, wanted to get as far away from that sound as he could. He felt Peter's hand on his shoulder, strong and steady. Finally, the three shapes shuffled away. Peter waited a long time before he stood up, and they continued down the trail. Peter heard the gurgling of Goggy Creek and let out a silent sigh of relief. The flesh-eaters would never dare follow them this far. He crouched on the bank and put his hands in the fast-moving water. "This water's safe to drink," Peter said, and began slurping down large handfuls. He splashed his face, glad to wash away the residue of the city. He hated the city, hated all the concrete, the noise, the stink of exhaust and garbage. But worse than all that, the city was full of mankind. Mankind and all their cruelty and brutality. He glanced at Nick. The kid was holding up pretty good. He'd done well in the mist. Peter had been sure he'd lost him, and yet the boy had found him on his own. Peter couldn't remember any other child doing that. This boy showed spunk, showed promise. Just the kind of child the devils are looking for, Peter thought. This one just might live a while. Peter watched the boy drink. It had been a long night, and the boy looked worn out, exhausted. Good, Peter thought. A deep sleep will make things easier. Up ahead's a good spot to rest, Peter said. Nick nodded, and they moved on. The two of them lay between a cluster of boulders on a makeshift bed of straw. Peter stared up at the overcast night sky.
I miss the stars.
Nick yawned. Maybe it'll clear up soon.
No,
Peter said.
The mist is eternal. The lady protects Avalon, but at the cost of our dear moon and stars.
Avalon? Nick said. I thought that was in Britain somewhere.
Used to be,
Peter said. What do you mean?
Oh, you'll see.
Sure. Okay,
Nick mumbled and closed his eyes. Peter watched the boy until he was sure Nick was fast asleep, then rose, slipping silently out from the boulders. There below him, a giant tree grew out from the cliff base. A single tendril of gray smoke wove its way through its craggy limbs. A solid, round door was set into the trunk, thick iron spikes protruding from its planks. Above the door hung a toothless human skull atop a thigh bone. Peter rapped on the door three times. A moment later, the peephole slid open. One slanted eye peered out at him.
I bring fresh blood,
Peter said, and grinned. Part 2. Devil Tree. Chapter 4. Gaul.
It will all end soon,
the child thief thought as he moved steadily through the forest, back toward the shore, back toward the mist.
Nick's with the devils now. His fate is in their hands. What will happen, will happen.
He slid from shadow to shadow, stopping frequently to listen, to watch, trying to keep his mind focused on the danger and away from what he had done, what he had left to do, because thinking about it didn't change it. Thinking about it only led to distraction, and out here, on their part of the island, distraction would get you killed. Peter came to the edge of the thicket and scanned the beach. There, waiting for him, floated the mist. He could hear it calling, taunting him. Grimacing, he broke cover and started forward when he caught voices. The child thief ducked back and dropped behind a thick knot of roots. Five shadows sat against a chunk of driftwood not 30 paces away.
Flesh eaters! Fool!
Peter silently cursed himself.
You almost walked right into them.
He'd allowed the mist to distract him.
Stupid.
He reached instinctively for his sword and remembered he only carried his knife. One of them stood, his tattered shirt fluttering in the breeze.
There they be.
Peter followed his gaze. A line of dark figures came marching around the cove, easily 40 or 50 of them. He couldn't remember seeing so many out at once, not since the galleons first arrived.
What are they up?
His blood went cold. Even in the dark, he had no problem recognizing a tall silhouette. There was no missing the wide-brimmed hat with that ratty feather.
The captain.
Peter clutched his knife. The faintest glow of dawn touched the low clouds as the captain tromped his way up to the others.
Well?
Found some tracks, aye, but that be all. Tracks come right out of the mist, they do.
It's him,
the captain said, scanning the tree line.
The devil boy.
Think so, do ye?
Who else?
You want we should search the wood?
The captain shook his head wistfully.
We've no time this day.
He patted his sword.
But mark my word, I shall make a trophy of his head yet.
The line of shadowy figures halted behind the captain. Peter felt sure every eye was on him. He shuddered and managed to press himself closer to the ground, hoping they couldn't hear the thudding of his heart. Their hunger was insatiable. Every day they took more. Every day they burned and murdered their way closer to the heart of Avalon. Some boldly wore the bones of the dead around their necks.
How much blood will it take to make them stop? How many more children must die?
The captain turned to the line.
Who called a halt?
He shouted.
Move your pockmarked asses. We've much work to do.
The dark figures trudged on. As they passed, Peter caught sight of two large barrels being hauled along.
What's the captain up to now?
He felt his chest tighten. He glanced back the way he'd come.
I should go back. Should warn them.
He dug his nails into his palm.
No, there's no time. I have to bring more children. Just have to be quick. Have to get back before the captain lays all to waste.
The child thief slipped from the scrub even before the last flesh eater passed. He dashed from one piece of driftwood to the next, broke free from the last bit of cover, and sprinted toward the waves. The mist rolled up to greet him, seemed to almost dance in anticipation, like a dog awaiting a feeding. Peter's face tightened.
All things come with a price. No one knows that better than I.
He fought to clear his mind, knowing he'd never make it through the mist otherwise, took a deep breath, and entered the swirling vapor. The sounds from the beach died in the suffocating silence. Even his own thoughts felt muffled. He stood stock still as he searched for the path. Finding the path, walking between the worlds, was one of his gifts.
There,
he whispered, spotting the tenuous thread of gold sparkles as it drifted across the grayness. Peter caught up with the path and followed, moving quickly, and sooner than he would have liked, found himself staring at the Nike high top. He stopped.
Keep moving, he told himself. Keep moving or you'll be as dead as the rest of them.
But he heard Nick's words. If I'd fallen behind, would I still be out there? Wandering around, screaming your name until I died? Peter wondered how long the boy in the high tops had screamed his name.
The boy?
The child thief laughed at himself, an ugly, contemptuous laugh. The boy had had a name.
Jonathan. And Jonathan was among the Slua now, wasn't he?
Peter thought.
Well, what of it?
He whispered bitterly.
Whose fault is that? Am I to blame because he hadn't listened? It's better this way, he told himself. Better to let the mist sort them out, the weak from the strong.
Peter kicked the high top.
Everything comes with a price. Everything. Some things just cost more than others.
Chimes rang from somewhere far away, then muffled laughter and children singing. The mist began to stir. This got Peter moving, almost running, keeping his eyes forward, keeping to the path.
It will all end soon, he whispered.
The spongy ground gave way to asphalt, and the mist began to thin. The sun could be seen crawling up behind the buildings, and the sounds of the awakening city echoed down the long avenues of South Brooklyn. The mist slid back into the sea, its swirling, sparkling mass dissipating, leaving Peter standing alone. The child thief pulled his hood up and headed toward a distant cluster of bleak tenant buildings. A sign, covered in graffiti, proclaimed the complex to be the pride of the Brooklyn City Housing Commission. Peter understood none of the political implications of that sign, but he knew about slums and ghettos. Such squalid, impoverished places had always been fertile hunting grounds. The buildings were larger now, the accents and dress different, but the faces were the same destitute faces of centuries ago. The despair of the forgotten old, and the grim hostility of the futureless young. A breeding ground for troubled youth, sometimes too troubled. But time was short, and Avalon needed more children. He would take his chances. The child thief entered the housing complex through the back alleyways, sticking to the shadows, his keen senses alert for the dispirited and desperate, the abandoned and abused. For the lost child. Because lost children needed someone to trust, needed a friend, and Peter was good at making friends. He shimmied up a drain pipe and dropped onto a balcony cluttered with garbage bags. He situated himself beneath a rain-sodden sheet of plywood and waited for the boys and girls to come out and play. As he waited, an odor permeated his nostrils. Every bit as offensive as the sour rot of the garbage. It was the musky smell of grown-ups. Their sweat, their gastric utterances, their dandruff-ridden scalps, greasy pimple-pocked skin, wax-encrusted ears, hemorrhoid-infested rumps. He wrinkled his nose. It hadn't changed since the day he was born, over 1,400 years ago. He could vividly recall that day, the crushing pressure as his watery sanctuary strove to eject him, fighting to remain, a feeling not unlike drowning, sliding from his mother's womb, cold, hard hands clamping about his legs and tugging him into the world, the blurry, dazzling brightness, the numbing cold, the shock as someone slapped him across his bottom. The fury and frustration as he wailed at the blurry blob holding him, and their booming laughter. Then he was wiped down and passed to other hands, gentle, caressing hands that crushed him against warm, milk-swollen bosoms. Someone covered him in a blanket heated by the fireside, and he began to suckle. The milk had been sweet, and the woman had begun to hum a soft lullaby. Peter fell into the sweetest sleep he would ever know. The smells of grown-ups had not been offensive then, not when mixed with the spice of that large communal roundhouse, the smoky aromas from the great fireplace, salted meats and honey mead, roasted potatoes and boiled cabbage, the musty scent of the two wolfhounds, stale bedding hay, the sharp tang of fresh-cut spruce hanging from the ceiling beams. But what made it all so harmonious to his nostrils was the ever-pervasive smell of his mother, that warm, sweet milk smell that to him would always be the smell of love.
His eyes were amber then, with only the faintest specks of gold, and his ears, though oddly shaped, had yet to develop their pointed tips. Other than a particularly lush head of reddish hair, he looked like any other cupid-faced newborn. Peter wintered the first several weeks of his life, either in his mother's arms or in the great wicker basket by the hearth. His mother's face was lost to him now, but not her grass-green eyes, nor the glow of her bright red hair. His mother was never far, singing to him while she wove wool and mended tunics with her two golden-haired sisters. He slept away most of his day, dreamily watching his large family go about their daily routines, the two men and oldest boy leaving before dawn to hunt, the younger boys tending the sheep and gathering wood, the old bent man and his old bent wife going about their chores as long as the daylight would allow. At sunset, the hunters would return, and with the thick stone walls between them and the winter wind, the family would gather around the rough-hewn oak table for their evening meal. Day after day, Peter lay there watching and listening. Before long, he could make out words, then whole sentences. When he was 3 weeks old, he understood most everything said around him. Each night, before dinner, his mother would nurse him, wrap him in his blanket, and leave him in the large basket near the hearth to sleep while the family ate. But Peter didn't sleep. He watched and listened as they laughed and joked, cursed and argued, encouraged and consoled, as they shared the good and the bad of their days. And when they would laugh, he would smile, and the tiny specks of gold in his eyes would sparkle, for the sound of their mirth was a sweet song to his ears. One night, on the evening of his 7th week in the world, Peter decided he was done just watching, that he wished to join in. So he kicked his legs free of the blanket, sat up, and climbed over the side of his basket. His legs gave out from under him, and he landed on his bare bottom with a solid thump. "What's wrong with my legs?" he wondered. It had never dawned on him that he couldn't yet walk. Everyone else could. He pulled up onto wobbly legs and steadied himself on the rim of the basket. He looked out across the room. Suddenly, the table seemed a long way off. He took a tentative step, fell, pulled himself up, and tried again. This time, he didn't fall. He took another step, another, then let go of the basket and began to waddle his way across the room. By the 6th and 7th step, he was toddling toward the table, his face wrapped in concentration. The old man spotted him first. His jaw hung open in mid-chew, and a clump of potato rolled out of his mouth and bounced off the table. The old lady frowned and swatted the old man. He let out a cry and jabbed a bony finger at Peter. They all turned in time to see the naked infant stroll up to the table. Peter, delighted to have his family's full attention, put his small, chubby hands on his hips and grinned boldly, the gold flecks in his eyes now positively gleaming. When no one spoke, when no one did more than let out a high-pitched wheeze, Peter asked, "Can I join you?" But this being the first time he'd put words together, it came out more like, "An I oin oo?" He frowned at the odd sound of his own voice. The words hadn't come out right, and the alarmed and astonished looks confronting him confirmed this. His tiny brow furrowed, and he tried again. "Can I join you?" he said, much clearer. Then, with confidence, he said, "Can I join you? Can I?" He looked expectantly from face to face. Surely that was right. Yet still they stared at him with those wide, startled eyes. "If anything," he thought, "they look more alarmed than before, angry even." His smile faltered, and all at once he needed his mother, needed her badly, needed the reassurance that only her soft bosom and warm arms could provide. He put his arms out and took a step toward her. "Mama," he called. His mother stood up, knocking her chair over, her hands clutched at her mouth. Peter stopped. "Mama?" Fear. It was on all their faces. But there was more than fear on his mother's face. Her eyes glared at him as though accusing him of some horrible deed.
"What did I do?"
Peter wondered.
"What did I do?"
The old lady leaped up, brandishing a large wooden spoon.
"Changeling!" she cried. "Get it out of here!"
"No," his mother cried. She shook her head.
"He's no changeling. It's his baby, the one from the woods."
She looked around at them, her eyes wild and desperate.
"Now do you see? Now do you believe?"
No one was listening to her. All their eyes were on Peter.
"Keep it away from the children," the old woman cried.
The old man herded the younger children away from the table, pushing them to the back of the room as far away from Peter as he could. Peter's mother grabbed the old woman's sleeve.
"Stop it! Stop it! Peter's no changeling, Mama. I wasn't lying. He took me, the forest spirit."
She pointed at Peter.
"The forest spirit gave me that child."
The old woman stared at Peter's mother in horror.
"No, child, don't speak of it.
Never speak of it."
She shook her daughter.
"It is not yours. Do you understand me? It's a changeling."
The old woman glared at Peter.
"Asger, get it out of here before it hexes us all."
One of the men pulled the long meat fork from out of the ham. The oldest boy grabbed the broom, and together they moved toward Peter. Through a blur of tears, Peter saw them coming for him. The man that he'd thought of as Papa jabbed the fork while the boy circled around him. Peter took a step back.
"Catch it!"
the old woman howled.
"Don't let it get away!"
The broom slapped Peter from behind, knocking him to the gritty dirt floor. The boy pressed the broom onto Peter to hold him, the sharp twigs digging and poking into Peter's soft skin.
"Don't spill its blood in the house,"
the old woman yelled,
"or there will be sickness upon us all. Take it into the forest. Leave it for the beasts."
Hard, rough hands held him as the man corded prickly twine about his limbs. The twine bit into his skin, binding his arms to his body and his legs together. As the man and boy donned boots and furs, the old woman brought Peter's basket and blanket.
"Take anything that it has soiled. I will get the grease."
She poured warm grease from the ham into a pot and brought it over. The door was pulled open and a biting winter wind blew in. They took Peter outside into the night. Peter got one last look at his mother. She was on the floor, sobbing, her two sisters kneeling beside her, holding her.
"Mama,"
Peter cried. She didn't look up. The door shut. The old woman poured the warm grease all over Peter. It stung his eyes, soaked into the blanket and quickly congealed into a cold paste on his skin.
"It will make things go quicker," the old woman told them. "Now, take the creature far into the woods and leave it."
The old woman gave the man a wad of wool.
"Put this in your ears. No matter what it says, remember, that wicked thing is not of your loins."
Both the man and boy held a torch. They threaded the broom through the handle of the basket, and each carried an end. They marched off down the icy trail, the old woman watching them go from the door stoop. The cold bit at the infant's tiny nose.
Papa,
Peter called.
Papa, please. I'll be good. I promise. I'll be good. Papa. Please, Papa. Papa.
But no matter how Peter pleaded, the man wouldn't look at him. The man and the boy marched steadily, their mouths set tight. Neither spoke as they tracked deeper and deeper into the dark, frigid forest. Peter had no real idea how much time passed, but when they finally stopped, the moon was peeking down at him from high in the cloudy sky. They set him in a clearing surrounded by high shrub and an outcropping of crumbling rocks, then left in a hurry without a single look back. Peter watched the tree limbs waving to the moon. Thick clouds tumbled in and the shadows wove together. He struggled to free himself, but the bindings were too tight. His fingers and toes grew numb and the cold became unbearable. Peter shook all over.
Mama!
He called.
Mama!
Over and over he called her name. His mother never came, but something else did. Peter heard a loud sniffing and fell quiet. A large shadow emerged from the bush. Its shape reminded him of the hounds back at the house. The dim moonlight glinted off the beast's black eyes as it sniffed the air. Peter sensed the beast's hunger. He tried not to make any sounds, but couldn't help whimpering as the wolf slowly circled in on him. The wolf bit one end of the blanket and tugged, tipping the basket over and spilling the infant out onto the frozen ground. Now, fully exposed to the winter air, Peter began to wail. The wolf licked away the grease from the blanket, then moved to Peter. It shoved its snout into his face, licking the grease from his cheeks, neck, and along his belly, then clamped its jaws on Peter's leg and began to drag him into the bush. Peter yowled, but the wolf only clamped down tighter. There came a clatter from the rocks. The wolf let go of Peter and jerked its head up, ears alert.
A yuck,
came a gruff, gravelly voice. There, on the flat outcropping of stone, stood a man. Only it wasn't a man, really, as he couldn't have stood much higher than the wolf's shoulder. He was short in the legs, long in the arms, and solid through the chest and shoulders. His head was large, out of proportion, and grew straight from his shoulders. His skin was gray and gritty like the earth itself. He wore a patchwork of mangy animal furs, covered in dirt and alive with moss. His eyes were no more than black specks set deep beneath his protrusive brow. He saw Peter and grinned, exposing black gums and a sharp underbite of twisted teeth. The wolf's fur bristled, and a mean growl rumbled up from deep within its throat. The moss man hopped off the rock and into the clearing.
Go!
He yelled and clapped his hands together. The wolf dropped its head, peeled back its lips, displaying an arsenal of long, dangerous teeth, and snarled. The moss man let loose a snarl of his own, and before Peter could blink, charged and leaped upon the wolf. He wrestled a hold about the beast's mane, then bit into its ear, snarling and jerking his head side to side until he tore the wolf's ear completely off. The wolf howled, kicked, and spun. The moss man let go and sent the animal yelping away into the bushes with a solid kick to the hindquarters. He spat the ear onto the ground and stared at Peter while licking the blood from his lips.
A baby,
he said, then picked up a twig and poked Peter.
Make good stew. Ayuk.
His speech came out slow and staggered, like words were unnatural for him. Please don't eat me, Peter pleaded. Please, I'll be good.
The Moss Man's brow rose with surprise, then drew together suspiciously.
Baby can talk.
He crouched down, stuck his wide, flat nose into the crook of Peter's neck and sniffed deeply. Up close, Peter could see all manner of bugs and worms crawling around in the man's hair. The Moss Man looked puzzled. He wiped his finger through the bloody bite marks on Peter's leg and dabbed the blood to the tip of his tongue. The Moss Man's beady eyes grew round, and he spat into the dirt.
Fairy blood, he sneered. Fairy blood is bad, very bad.
His shoulders slumped. His face grew glum.
Can't eat, baby.
The Moss Man bent and picked up the wolf's ear, stuck the bloody end in his mouth, and started away. For a second, Peter was relieved to see him go. Then the bite of the cold reminded him that he was tied up, naked, and there was a hungry wolf nearby.
Wait! He cried. Don't leave me here!
The Moss Man kept walking.
Please!
Peter screamed.
Please stop! Please!
Peter's screams turned to sobs.
Please don't go!
The Moss Man turned around. He looked at Peter and scratched his chin. Finally, after a long minute, he asked,
Can you catch spiders?
What?
Peter asked.
Can you catch spiders? Lots of spiders in cave. Hate spiders. Ayuck.
Peter didn't want to go near any spiders, but he certainly didn't want to be left in the woods either. He nodded.
Yes, I can catch spiders.
The Moss Man considered, while Peter shivered. Finally, he grunted, shuffled back, and untied the infant.
No more crying. Hate crying. You follow. Keep up, a wolf gets you.
Peter crawled to his feet. He could barely stand. His feet were so numb. The Moss Man took off at a hearty pace, and Peter tried to follow, but fell after only a few steps. The frozen ground bit into his knees and hands, and he let out a cry. He got up and tried again, but the ice cut into the bottom of his tender feet. After only a dozen steps, he fell again. He tried crawling, but the pain was too much. He stopped. He could no longer see the Moss Man. It was dark. It was cold. He was lost. His knees were bleeding. He was naked and freezing to death. And there was a wolf somewhere nearby. Peter began to cry. The Moss Man reappeared, glaring at Peter with his small, dark eyes. His nose wrinkled up in disgust.
No crying. Hate crying.
Peter tried to stop, but couldn't. Instead, he began to bawl openly and loudly. The man put his hands over his ears.
Stop that!
He groaned and started away. He made about six strides, then stopped. He looked back at Peter, brows drawn together. Finally, he let out a great sigh and strolled back to the infant.
Okay. Okay, I not leave. Now stop crying.
Peter continued to wail. The Moss Man pointed to the hill behind him.
Gaul's Hill.
He thumbed his chest.
Gaul.
Peter wiped his nose with the back of his arm and fought back the tears.
I'm Peter,
he said, between big, hitching breaths. Gaul hunkered down.
Come, Peter. Climb up.
Peter climbed onto the man's back, got a firm hold on the man's hair, and clung tight as the moss man got to his feet. Gaul handed Peter the wolf's ear.
Here, for you.
He wrapped Peter's feet in his large, warm hands, and away they went, following the icy trail up the hill while Peter chewed on the wolf's ear. They came to a dark hollow dug into a ledge. To Peter it looked like little more than a hole. Dirty straw, tufts of greasy fur, and gnawed bones littered the worn earthen entrance. Shoes hung across the entranceway, sandals and boots, about a dozen altogether. Small shoes. Children's shoes. Gaul set Peter down and grinned.
Gaul's home. Very warm. Very nice.
Just where the fuck you been?
Recalled to the present, the child thief started. He glanced over his shoulder into the apartment. There was a light on now, and through the thin, sagging curtain he saw a grotesquely large woman standing in her bra and panties, hands on hips. She was addressing the man leaning against the open front door. It was raining, a light drizzle that turned the gray public housing to the color of mud.
I asked you a question, the woman continued, her voice rising. I said just where the fuck has your ass been all night?
The man shrugged. He didn't come in.
How come your shirt's inside out, Jermaine? Huh? How come?
Jermaine looked down at his shirt, then back up at the woman and shrugged again.
You've been with that bitch again, ain't you?
The man didn't answer.
Don't give me that look, she shrieked. You know who I'm talking about.
The woman snatched a bottle off a TV tray and pointed it at the man.
Woman, the man said, his speech slurred. You need to calm down. It ain't like, goddamn you, Jermaine! Goddamn you!
She threw the bottle. It exploded against the door right next to the man's head. Then she was slapping him. The man shoved her away.
You need to back off, bitch! You need to just back!
She came at him again, and this time he punched her hard in the stomach, hard enough to knock her into the living room and onto the floor. The woman lay there, making a dreadful sound like someone choking to death.
Crazy bitch!
The man shouted.
Crazy fucking bitch!
He slammed the door and was gone. The woman didn't get up. She just lay there clutching her stomach and bawling. Peter had had enough. He hopped down from the balcony. Keeping his head low, he walked the buildings, his golden eyes peeping out from beneath his hood, scanning the courtyards, the playgrounds. His thoughts kept returning to the captain. The barrels. Time was running out. He had to find a child today. Chapter 5. Devils. Light droplets of warm rain sprinkled down onto Nick's face. He could feel the wetness running into his eyes, his mouth, his hair, pulling him out from the depths of sleep. Nick wiped his face, forced himself awake, and blinked up into the faint, misty morning glow. Three tiny blue people, no bigger than mice, were peeing on him.
What the fuck?
Nick cried. He sat up fast and rammed his head against the top of his cage.
Cage?
He spat repeatedly, trying to rid his mouth of the salty, sour taste.
What the hell was he doing in a cage?
He shook his head and wiped the pee out of his eyes, then spat some more. There were at least 24 of them staring down at him, some no bigger than grasshoppers, others closer to the size of rats, thin, spindly, human-like creatures with silky insect wings and sharp, whipped tails,
They were nude, their skin a deep sapphire blue with wild manes of black or blue hair running down their backs. Peter had said something about fairies and pixies and goblins. Of course, Peter had said a lot of nutty things. Were these pixies? It really didn't matter to Nick at the moment. He was more concerned with the way these creatures were looking at him, like he'd be good to eat.
"Shoo," he whispered.
They continued to stare at him with their cruel, unblinking eyes.
"Shoo,"
he said louder, waving his hand at them. They hissed and bared needle-sharp teeth.
"Scat,"
Nick said, and swatted at the top of the cage. They leaped up as one, the air suddenly alive with the humming of wings. Hovering, they shrieked at him like feral cats. Nick slid as far away from them as he could get. He grabbed a handful of straw from the bottom of his cage and threw it at them. Startled, a small brown mouse darted out from beneath his cage, bounding across the stone floor. The pixies were at it in a flash. The mouse let out a skin-crawling squeal as they pounced. Fur, flesh, and blood spattered the stones, a dogpile of snarling, frenzied blue bodies as they fought viciously over the choicest bits.
"Christ," Nick whispered, clutching his hands to his chest. "I gotta get out of here."
He glanced about the gloom and noticed there were at least a dozen kid-sized cages stacked against one wall. Like his, they were built from branches and twine. Many were covered in raggedy tarps, looking for all the world like rotting corpses of beasts. A cluster of spears leaned against one another, teepee style, and in their center, Nick swallowed, a human skull. A sharp clack came from somewhere behind him. The pixies stopped fighting and stood up, their faces alert, heads flicking about as they searched the darkness. A soft thud, followed by a long, low growl, slid out of the shadows, and the pixies zipped up and away, leaving Nick alone. Nick found himself wishing they'd stayed, anything but to be alone in a cage, in the gloom, with whatever had made that noise. Another creak, this one closer. Pushing his face against the bars, Nick strained to see into the shadows. He made out a twisting pillar of roots that disappeared into the darkness above. Nick noted a shadow hunched next to the roots, and the shadow, it was moving. It rocked back and forth, then darted away.
Oh, crap.
What was that?
The room grew brighter and the fog began to thin. He could now make out objects hanging from the walls. Nick blinked. Knives with wicked curved blades hung in rows. Alongside were spiked clubs and an assortment of jagged-edged hatchets, instruments designed to rend and maim, and they all looked well used. Hanging above the weapons were three skulls tied together in a pyramid. Their leathery wormhole flesh stretched across silent screams. A pair of leg bones set in a cross hung below, forming a triptych of Jolly Rogers.
"Gotta get out of here now!"
He pushed on the cage. It didn't open. He noticed the front was tied with leather straps. He frantically tugged at the ties. A low hiss came from Nick's left. He jerked about in time to see something skittered by on all fours. Nick gave up on the ties, no longer wanting out, only hoping the bars would keep him safe from whatever was out there.
"God, get me out of here," he whimpered.
The fog continued to lift, and he could now see all manner of spears and swords hanging from the walls. He noticed a huge fireplace, easily big enough for three grown men to stand in. Several cooking pots, kid-size cooking pots, hung from greasy black chains. Then he saw the bodies. He could just make out their limp, lifeless forms hanging on the far side of the chamber. How many were there?
4, 5 maybe. They looked to be children.
Oh, good God, Nick's mind screamed at him. Just what kind of place is this?
Low howls issued from the shadows all around him. Something grunted like a pig, then snorted, then snickered. Giggles broke out. They sounded like children, strange and wicked. Nick knew he would lose it if they didn't stop. A clump of shadows crept into the light, and all the air left Nick's lungs. They were human, but barely. Their bodies gangly and spidery, childlike in their proportions, but a bit off, as though they'd been stretched. Large round spots and long streaks of body paint ran along their legs and arms. Their muscles gleamed in the dim light, lean and wiry. Some wore hides, matted and mangy, festooned with bones, tusks, and twigs, their ankles and wrists layered in bracelets of leather and twine. Their faces were hidden beneath devilish masks of hide and hair, feathers and antlers. They closed in on him, dancing about with quick epileptic movements. They surrounded the cage and peered in with wild, crazy golden eyes, eyes just like Peter's. Nick now understood that Peter had indeed played him. The pointy-eared boy had tricked him so that these things could...
Could what?
Nick glanced at the long knives, at their hungry eyes.
What do you want?
Nick shouted, his voice quivering. They answered by rolling their eyes around, like victims of delirium, by grinning wide, toothy grins and clacking their teeth together, clacking and clacking and clacking. The sound was deafening in the silence of the room.
No, no, no,
Nick thought.
No more, please.
Nick withdrew within himself then, just like in the mist. He had no desire to watch his own death. But if he had to, he wanted to be in the very back row with his hands over his eyes. They untied his cage and dragged him out, strong, cruel fingers pinching into his flesh. Someone put a necklace made of bone and teeth, fingers and ears, human fingers and ears, around his neck. They pulled him over to the pillar and began to dance around him in circles, wrapping him in twine, all the while giggling and flicking their tongues at him, rolling their eyes and clacking their teeth. He wanted them to go ahead and kill him, anything to stop that awful clacking. There came a clang from somewhere far off. The demon spawn, the monster children, or whatever they were, stopped in their tracks. They fell silent. The mist was all but gone now, and morning light filtered in from several angular windows. The extent of the circular chamber gradually materialized out of the gloom. The walls were a mix of rough-hewn stone and natural cave formation. Nick could clearly see a red door surrounded by giant roots, roots as thick as barrels. Nick couldn't imagine what size tree could have roots that big. He tried to see the top, but it disappeared into the roof of the chamber. The demon spawn were all staring at the red door. One of them spoke, his voice hushed.
The devil beast comes.
Comes to break bones and chew marrow, said another. Several answered in anxious whispers.
We shall all eat soon.
They spread out, forming a wide circle, and began to smack their closed fists into their open palms. Fear sharpened Nick's senses, and he became acutely aware that the air smelled of stale sweat, boiled meat, wet leaves, and beetles. He studied the red door. Could there really be something coming to cook and eat him? He didn't want to believe it. Yet he found his eyes straying to the knives and hatchets, the dark stains saturating the dirt, the child-sized pots hanging in the fireplace. He couldn't get the thought of the hanging bodies out of his head.
I don't want to die,
he thought, and realized he was crying. Bells jangled behind the red door, louder and louder. Then it stopped. There came the clack of a bolt being thrown, and the door swung slowly inward. A monster stood in the doorway, a head taller than the other creatures, draped in hides and wearing a mask of bone and fur. A pair of goat horns twisted out from either side of its head, and a tangle of coarse hair was captured in a thick braid that ran down the length of its back. And all of it, skin, mask, fur, horns, was covered in cracking red paint. It carried a short club with one long jagged hook protruding from its end. It locked its eyes on Nick, raised the club, and let loose a loud snort.
Oh no,
Nick cried.
No, no, no!
He jerked wildly at his bindings, tugging and pulling until he freed his arms. He yanked down the twine around his waist and legs, stumbled to the ground as he tore his feet free. Nick rolled to his feet, glanced back, saw the devil beast coming for him, and ran. He tried to break out of the ring of creatures, to barrel right through them, but they grabbed him and shoved him back. The devil beast caught Nick across his face with an open palm. Pain exploded in Nick's head and he went sprawling to the stones. He crumpled into a ball and lay there clutching his head.
It's over,
Nick thought.
I'm dead.
The devil came for him, driving a hard kick into Nick's upper thigh. Nick screamed, saw a foot coming for his face, and managed to move. The kick caught his shoulder and sent him tumbling.
Stop it!
Nick screamed. The devil tromped after him, raising the club with its wicked hook above his head. Nick sprung out of the way. The club hit the stones, getting knocked loose from the devil beast's grasp and bouncing across the floor to the middle of the ring. Nick jumped up, limping away, trying to keep some distance between himself and his tormentor. The devil leaped forward, catching Nick by the arm, spun him around, and backhanded him across the face. Searing pain and white-hot light sent Nick reeling, fighting to keep his feet. And still the devil came. Nick tasted blood, touched his lip, and was shocked by the amount of blood on his hand.
What do you want?
Nick screamed, as though he didn't know, as though he expected anything other than being brutally beaten to death. The devil just continued to track him around and around, giving no answers, a predator intent on its prey.
What?
Nick screamed.
What?
Nick spotted the hooked club lying in the center of the ring. His eyes shot back and forth between the hook and the devil. The devil stopped and stared at him. Nick dove for it, snatching the hook up off the stones. The weight of it surprised him and he almost dropped it. He held it in both hands and pointed the wicked hook at the devil.
Come on!
Nick cried, blood and spit flying from his lips.
Come on, you motherfucker!
The devil just stood there.
Come on!
Nick screamed, the club shaking as his arms quivered. The creatures around him began to chant,
blood, blood, blood,
on and on, until Nick thought he would go mad.
Enough!
He let out a howl and rushed the devil, bringing the hook around in a wide overhand swing, intent on sinking it deep into the devil's skull. At the last possible second, the devil caught Nick's arm at the wrist and wrung the club away. The weapon bounced off the stones with a loud clank, and the chamber fell silent. Good, the devil said, and pushed his mask back. Nick found himself looking not at a beast, but a boy. The boy smiled at Nick. You did good. He clasped Nick's hand in his own and raised it up.
New blood for Deviltree, he shouted, then threw his head back and howled.
The creatures joined in, howling and beating the floor, the entire chamber rung with their fervor. They slid off their masks, and now Nick could plainly see that beneath the wild hair and body paint, they were just a bunch of stupid-ass kids. He caught sight of the blue pixies leaping up and down among the rafters, mimicking the boys like little blue monkeys, adding their feral shrieks to the cacophony. The whole chamber rung with hooting, braying, and cackling. The world seemed a spinning kaleidoscope of insanity, and Nick knew that he'd gone stark raving mad.
Chapter 6. Wolf. The child thief sat on a bench near the playground. Buildings loomed over him on all five sides of the large courtyard. As morning pushed into noon, the beehive of apartments began to wake up. He scanned the balconies, alert for any sign of wayward youth, but mostly found himself confronted with the same tired, hungover faces of the adults. They congregated in small clusters, lounging listlessly about the balconies, often with their apartment doors propped open and stereos blasting out into the courtyard. There was laughter here and there, but for the most part, it sounded mean. Many of the people just stared blankly, their eyes glazed over, reminding Peter of the dead in the mist. A gleeful squeal caught Peter's ear, followed by a burst of spirited laughter that drew him like candy. A few younger kids had braved the drizzle to slip down the slide and climb the monkey bars. They formed teams and began an energetic game of tag. The child thief watched them, smiling. Here, among so much drudgery, oblivious to the profane graffiti marring every available surface, these children could find joy.
They can always find joy, he thought, because they still have their magic.
Peter found himself wanting nothing more than to run and play with them. The same deep desire he had when he first came across children all those long years ago. Only things hadn't gone so well then. His smile faded.
No, that had been a day of hard lessons.
He was 6 years old by then, slipping silently through the woods in his raccoon pelt. It flapped out behind him like a cape, the long, striped tail bouncing in rhythm with his stride. He wore the head pulled over his face like a hood, and his gold-flecked eyes peered out from the raccoon mask, scanning the woods, searching for game. It was spring, so he wore only a loincloth and rawhide boots beneath his coon skin. He carried a spear in each hand and a flint knife tucked into his belt. His body was painted with berry juice and mud to disguise his scent. Gaul had taught him that, as well as the importance of always carrying two spears, a light one for game and a stouter one for protection against the larger beasts in the forest. Peter placed a handful of walnuts in the center of a clearing, then ducked beneath a tall cluster of bushes. When he spied two brown squirrels in a nearby tree, he cupped his hands and mimicked a turkey foraging. Gaul had taught him this trick too, that it was better to mimic an animal other than the one you were hunting, because rarely could you fool an animal with its own call, and nothing brought game quicker than the sound of other animals feeding. Sure enough, both squirrels scurried his way. Peter slowly set the larger spear down and hoisted the light spear to his shoulder. The squirrels saw the nuts, saw each other, and raced for the prize. Peter stood and threw. The spear hit its mark, leaving one squirrel behind as the other raced away, chattering angrily at Peter. Peter whooped and leaped up.
No spider soup for me, he thought. Tonight I get squirrel stew.
a wolf trotted into the clearing and stood between Peter and his prize. The wolf had only one ear. Peter froze. The beast locked its dark eyes on Peter. Its lips peeled back as though it were actually grinning. Peter snatched up his heavy spear and thrust it out before him.
"No," Peter said. "Not this time."
A low growl rumbled from the wolf's throat. Peter held his ground. The wolf had plagued him relentlessly over the last several months. Every time Peter made a kill, the wolf showed up and stole his meal. Peter was tired of spider soup. Today he would keep his prize. The wolf's eyes laughed at Peter, taunting the boy, daring him, as though it would like nothing better than to tear his throat open. Peter swallowed loudly, his mouth suddenly dry. Gall had told him there was only one way to master the wolf, to attack it head on.
"Wolf is hunter,"
he'd said.
"When you hunt wolf, wolf get mixed up. No know what to do. Then you beat wolf. You will see. Show fear,"
Gall had laughed.
"Then wolf will eat you. A yuck."
"Now," Peter told himself, "rush in. Stab it through the heart."
The wolf lowered its head and began to slowly circle the boy. Peter knew what the wolf was up to. They'd played out this dance many times. The wolf was trying to cut off his retreat, trying to get between him and the nearest tree. Peter knew if he took his eyes off the wolf,